Can't live talk about books and stuff.
And welcome to Can't Lit. It is a podcast. I am Dina.
Hi, Dina.
Marie Delbucchia.
Oh, is your middle name Marie?
It is.
How could you just be learning that?
I don't know. How do I not know this?
I guess I don't say it enough.
I guess I haven't signed enough of your legal documents.
Yeah, Jen. Why aren't you looking at my passport more often?
I can't believe there's any revelations left between the two of you.
Yeah, there's always more to explore.
I mean, I'm Jen.
Just Jen. Like, share. Needs one name only. Also, weirdly, recording an ABBA tribute album, similarly to Cher. I can't wait to hear it, Jen. Really excited.
If I could turn back time.
Oh, it's a Cher tribute album, not an ABBA tribute album. Which
ABBA. No, I would rather I would do Cher.
I like that.
Because, you know, I just saw her talking about how she had a brief love affair with Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm loving her current, like, Mamma Mia tour.
Yeah.
All her interviews are great.
Her interviews are so funny. And she said that Tom Cruise is in the top five of her lifetime of lovers.
Yeah, it's really intense.
And I would, if I could get in a room with her, I'd really want to know, like, why Tom Cruise? What made him so great?
I overall would love to know why Tom Cruise is great to people.
Well,
he's never been interesting to me personally.
No, me neither.
But there is the ridiculous action movie set pieces, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's someone who jumps off of, you know, a 100-story tower is sort of interesting.
That is true. And this is very insightful commentary coming from our amazing guest, writer, super smart person.
Multi-genre writer,
possessor of excellent hair.
Oh, excellent. We only have good hair.
Kim Fu. Great style.
Kim Fu. Great shoes.
My two favorite compliments are, I like your book and I like your hair.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're both, your book and hair are great. Thank you, Kim Fu, for being here. Kim came from Seattle.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
We are recording, not live.
No.
At the University of the Fraser Valley.
In Abbotsford, BC.
In Abbotsford or Ferd. It's unclear. There was some shade being thrown earlier at this literary festival that we are currently at.
Yeah. But we want to give a shout out. And we're in a nice and lovely room in the Student Union building. I believe it is part of the Cascade offices.
Yeah. We were given a very nice, quiet room to record in, where Rosie McDougall is also permitted to roam free.
It's a very dog-friendly room.
Yeah, it's
great,
really
dog
good.
Dog nests.
She's been sitting in this rattan chair, and there are pieces of the rattan behind the chair that seem to have fallen off the chair, and I bet she's going back there to
chew. She's definitely
it.
Chewing them.
Yeah, that's fine. But they're discarded pieces of rattan.
Yeah, I mean, it seems fine.
And also, I love the word rattan.
I love the word rattan. I also just love, I love a rattan chair.
Did you guys ever see those commercials in, like, the 80s? I remember these in the very early 80s when I was really little. And it was for a furniture store that only sold rattan. And it was called Malacca.
Yeah, Malacca for the money. Yeah. I can't believe you know that. I've literally tried to find the old ads. Yeah. And there was this, like, beautiful black man with a smooth voice wearing a suit.
Tuxedo. Wasn't he wearing tails?
Yeah. Yeah. And he would be like, Malacca for the money.
Rattan.
Malacca for the price.
Rattan.
And you'd be
go.
Like, what? Yeah. And it was all basically like, why isn't your home covered in rattan? And I loved those ads.
So good.
Maybe they were regional.
They must have been BC.
I also always think about the Kool-Aid store that's still over there.
The
on
Witch
Hastings
store?
Street.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a bamboo.
The bamboo products.
Products, yeah.
And like you can get parasols and lanterns.
Apparently, they also at that store will fix wooden furniture still.
It's been there forever.
They're like smart. They're smart, talented people who will still fix your busted up. Yeah,
the
Rosie, you take
a run out of people who know how to fix wooden furniture.
This is a concern. I talked in a previous episode about the furniture upholstery place on 4th Avenue that's going to close, and like I've already talked about the umbrella store closed. No one's around to fix my umbrella anymore. We just have to dispose of them.
See, this is the thing, disposing of things. I don't like this at all.
I would love to be a more dexterous person, but I'm not good at anything that requires like small hand coordination.
Can you sew?
I can sew okay, but yeah. It's not like if I was doing hand sewing, I could not really do a neat line. I can use a machine okay, but I'm not a precise person.
No, me neither.
Like, I would love to be better. I came from many seamstresses, and I am not good at it.
No. A gonzo effective seamstress is still pretty good, though.
Yeah, I mean, I can make stuff happen. I fix my tights all winter long.
You can fix tights?
If they're thicker tights. Yeah, because they always, my feet are disgusting and they're super dry, like razor blades. They're horrible. So that's the part that most people tell you, no, the thighs blow out, not on my shoe or my feet.
It's always my toes.
Always the toes, yeah. Or the heel for me.
You can fix those.
I just turn it inside out and I just stitch do it. Like a really tough stitch. Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
I've never done that.
All I'm saying is it's worth it because I want to get a couple more wears out of those tights.
How many Cantlit listeners are still listening?
Yeah, like, does anyone care? So, we have Kim Fu here. We're at a literary festival. Rosie's chewing on a bone. There's so much activity happening.
She barked at all the male writers here.
She did. It was very funny.
Except Wade Compton.
Except former guest Wade Compton.
She really likes Wade
Compton. And former guest Belay. Did she bark at him?
No.
Belay Nickerson?
No, but then he gave her treats.
That's true. Former guest Aaron Chapman traveled in a car with us. All friends of the podcast. Yes. She is reluctantly accepting him at this point.
Reluctantly.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of stink, I still. Yeah.
So, what's happening?
Yeah, what is happening? That's a good question. I'll tell you what's happening.
Great. I look forward to hearing it.
Okay. So, what is that? Well, we're at Abbotsford. Ford. Ford. Okay. Is it supposed to be Ford?
I have no idea.
Okay.
This is our first Abbotsford recording.
Anyway, we're really happy to be here. I was the writer in residence here 2 years ago. So I kind of know this place and I got, Kim Fu and Dina Delbucchia and Aaron Chapman here in a car safely, which is a minor miracle. So that was good. You know, what's happening is, I think by the time the podcast comes out, I'm allowed to say, but I have a poetry collection coming out. We have,
this podcast will happening. Come out in a couple of weeks.
Oh yeah, no, it'll happen.
Great.
I can announce it at that point. And it's coming out with Woolsack and Wynn, fall 2020.
Wonderful.
Debut poetry collection.
Debut poet.
Yeah. And
do you have a title for this collection?
It's called The Shadow List.
The Shadow List.
I think the title's staying. It's a good title.
I like it.
Is the poem you read today going to be in it?
No.
The poem you read
maybe.
Today at this literary
festival? Maybe now.
Oh yeah, that could go in.
It could go in. Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Are you writing a lot of new poems?
I have to write some new poems. I think I have to write about 15.
Oh, that's pretty.
It's doable.
I mean, between now and 2020, that's a between decent now, amount of time.
I think my my final deadline is probably like spring 2020. So I got time.
Yeah, you got lots of time.
I got time.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. Congratulations.
Being edited by former guest friend of the podcast, Paul Vermeersch. Also friend of the podcast, Kinesia Lupin.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Nice. So many amazing friends.
Yeah, we feel good about it. We feel good about it. What's happening with you, Dina?
I just celebrated my 20-year anniversary with my best friend. And we had a very fun party.
It was a good party.
We had a really fun party. It was a complete delight. We had many friends there. My parents were there. They just love any excuse to come to Vancouver and hang out for
Your
a party.
Parents are so great.
Yeah, they're very fun. And we went to Party Bazaar, which is a huge party store in Vancouver that is closing soon. Forever.
Mm-hmm. And it's closing soon?
Yeah.
Are you
after
joking?
Yeah, after Halloween, that's it. Unsurprisingly, the building is being torn down and some condos are going up.
That store is the best.
It is great. As someone though pointed out on Facebook, fair point. They do carry a lot of racist costumes, or they did.
Yeah.
Fair. But again, like anytime an independent business is torn down for condos, I can have complicated but angry feelings.
Okay, you know, where are we going to get our giant helium balloons?
I don't know. I have four huge helium balloons in my living room right now, and I'm going to be living with them for weeks, possibly months.
Possibly months.
I have a big two and a big zero, and I have another one that's like an iridescent star. And then I have just a big one that says, happy anniversary.
We had my mom's 80th birthday party in July.
Yeah, you got to get those. Did you get a big 80?
Yeah, we got a big 80. Yeah. And it's like in our house still. They haven't deflated.
I don't know. And I guess the woman who runs it has been doing it for a really long time. And she's like, I'm tired. You know,
one of my students, I don't know if he listens to this, big ups, Matthew Brandenburg, wrote a horror short story set in a store like that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, where nobody wanted to take it over. So the guy had to like kidnap and like zombify people to take over his store.
That's a great story.
It's a great concept.
It's a good concept. Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, so that's what's going on. It was great.
I got Roxanne and Dina matching wrist corsages.
This is one of the greatest parts. We got not super dressed up, but like dressed up. And then Jen brought us, wrist corsages.
Well, it was funny. I went to the florist and I'm like, can I buy a couple of wrist corsages? And she's like, when do you need it? I'm like, today. And she's like, okay, sure. I think I can do that. She's like, what's it for? I said, oh, my friends are celebrating their 20th anniversary. She's like, oh, isn't that nice? And it's wedding anniversary. And I'm, no, they're just celebrating friends. Their friend anniversary. And she's like, oh, what kind of corsages do you want?
I love it.
I'm like, pretty ones, so they have to be matching.
Anyway, they were very pretty. Mine is drying on the side of my shelf that I use for my liquor cabinet.
20-year friendship is more of an achievement than a 20-year marriage, because there's no like societal pressure keeping you guys together. There was no legal reasons keeping you together. You guys had to work at it.
Yeah. This is an excellent point. And not only did we have to work at it, but then like other people, when you are friends with someone, constantly question, why is your friendship so close? Why aren't you in a romantic relationship? Or for years, people would always be like, oh, if only you and Roxanne were just like a couple. And I'm like, I get that would also be great. But like, I think that the constant like romantic pressure for people can do damage to any other type of relationship.
I don't understand, like, when the constant, yes, the pressure to be a romantic couple, that's just, who cares?
It's weird. It's like when people would always ask if Daniel and I were married, even though very clearly all his poems were about, like, dudes and being a gay man.
Do you know how many
people
asked me if you guys were together?
It's really funny.
And I would yell, no, he's gay, and then laugh.
It's just very, the concept. The heteronormativity of just existence is absurd.
I never thought you guys were together. I briefly thought you were related.
Oh, that makes sense. That's fair. That's fair. But overall, I very seldom, unless I'm told, for this reason, assume people are together. It's shifted my thinking.
I guess it means that some people can't imagine having that level of intimacy and not having sex with somebody, or that getting so much out of somebody in your life but not having sex with
them. Or not even just not having sex with them, but not like cohabitating in a way where you're like, I don't know, you have to file your taxes together or whatever. Like, well, if that's romance for you, then it should die.
Yeah, no, because like my therapist goes on about like support and partners and, asks me who my, partners are. And she doesn't mean like romantic partners. Yeah. That's not what she means.
But I mean, even think about the way we interact with people with our own writing. Like both Kim and I back to back did our MFAs, and the people that we met there are integral to the work that we now do, whether it's community based or whether it's the writing. Like,
yes, absolutely.
All those relationships are super important.
The way I thanked Andrea Bennett in my acknowledgments, as I think is the way a lot of people thank their life partner. And I noticed you had done something similar.
With Daniel.
With Daniel, and the acknowledgments of your books.
And I mean, even when I thank Roxanne,
Andrea Bennett, former guest, friend of the podcast.
I always say things like, thank you for feeding and taking care of me.
Oh, yeah.
Because that is, she's not a writer. She's not reading my work. But, I mean, sometimes she is. That's not necessarily true. But the things that she is doing to help me, pursue anything in my life is really important. I love that I did that. That you did that when I was reading the acknowledgments in your book. I was like, yes.
In the acknowledgments for The Conjoined, I actually wrote a list of my friends who, heard me cry over the period of time that I wrote that book. And it was like, they never expect it, right? Because we're not married. It's not like they didn't help me write the book necessarily. But like, they deserve to be shouted out.
I agree. And I think so often, there's all of this pressure too. Like if you are in a relationship, you have to stay in it for societal reasons, even if it's terrible or whatever is going on. Like,
oh, women are never allowed to leave relationships.
Yeah. Look at what happened to, friend of the podcast, Ariana Grande.
Yes, she is a friend of the podcast.
Ariana Grande, friend of the podcast. Like, her ex-boyfriend dies and everyone is like
blaming her.
Cause you're right. You know what? Every woman, especially a very young woman, is supposed to take care of their ill, mentally ill, addicted, whatever partner for the end of time so that they can just be a caretaker for life.
I mean, that poor girl. I really like Ariana Grande.
I like her too.
Personally. But like that poor thing when she's getting all that.
It's some bullshit. Speaking of bullshit, just kidding. Yeah, what's happening?
Yeah, what's happening to you, Kim?
Just because you were talking about the anniversary, I just celebrated my dog's second birthday.
Yay! Aww. Happy birthday, Dixie!
Tell the listeners about your dog.
She is a black lab mix. I assume she's mixed with a bulldozer. She's a little bit of a nightmare, but I love her very much because she's very cute. Follow me on Instagram because it's all just pictures of
her. It's really
she's great. Super cute.
Are you Skimfu?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. We'll address this later when I talk to this follow you.
I took her for a hike, which is very challenging because she hates everybody. So we had to go.
Were there people on this hike or creatures?
We had to go to an obscure park and like an obscure part of an obscure park on kind of a, you know, early morning in the rain, so that she could have it to herself and enjoy it in peace. And then I made her a steak. Actually, I made her two steaks because they came in two packs. And she spent a long time sniffing it and looking at me suspiciously, like, this can't possibly be for me.
Did you cook it?
Trouble. Yes, I did.
Good for you. And did she lick it for a long time and not really eat it?
She kind of like stuck her nose in it for a long time and looked at me suspiciously, like she was waiting to see if she'd get in trouble. And then once it was like clear that it was okay, she just home and then it was gone.
Oh, like in one chomp?
Like in like 5 seconds.
That's impressive.
She ate two steaks that were like chopped up.
That is unbelievable.
She's great. A big dog.
She seems big.
I used to make Molly what I called puppy stew. So I would buy, you know, meat and potatoes and make a stew for her birthday. And it was like her favorite thing.
When I was trying to make her like people, I would invite them over and then give her beef stew, like beef and potatoes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And be like, see, when people come over, you get beef. Isn't that wonderful?
Is that working?
No.
So is there anyone that she likes?
Other than me and my partner, not really.
That's so funny.
She likes people temporarily while they're facing away from her giving her treats or when they're throwing her a ball. But the moment the ball stops or she like stops to think about it and gets a look at them, then she doesn't like them anymore.
I do. I mean, I know some other people that have dogs that are like this.
Yeah, that's tough.
Like that either they have trauma or they're just like picky or... Yeah.
We got her when she's pretty old and she came with a very sad letter. Yeah. So I think she had a very rough... I mean, she wasn't that... She was a year old. But I gather like a lot of difficulty had happened already by that point. And she was actually in kind of like trauma shutdown at that point, which is why I thought she had a totally different personality because she was just totally shut down and she was so scared that she seemed really passive and gentle. But then once she became like comfortable and confident, then she's like crazy and wild and has totally different problems.
Okay. How long did that process take in my own self-interest? Wondering if Rosie's going to have a complete personality
show. No, it was only like a few weeks.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Whew, I think she's who she is.
Yeah.
Rosie seems
very confident. Like she knows the business.
Well, she's confident. Her new best friend is a French bulldog named Olive.
My neighbor's French bulldog like got out and he got her and it was fine, but it was really funny to watch him chase her because it looks like a football with legs.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Like a football with a real flat face. Yeah. Snorting.
Yeah, the whole time. Because she's, you know, she's trying not to get picked up, so she was like dodging a little bit.
Oh my god,
the French bulldogs.
Speaking of dogs, in your book, The Lost Girls of Camp Forevermore.
I love this book.
I love it too. There is a prominent dog.
Yes, Wolf.
Do you have dog-related questions?
Yeah. I mean...
I don't know. If you don't, I'm happy to...
Well, I want to ask this question about the dog in it because... he feels... Yes, he's very oddly human. And he is that character. The character who owns him is named...
Nita.
He's the only... it feels like he's the only creature that she loves pretty much her entire life.
Yeah. I think that is definitely a fair reading.
And everything I write has dogs in it also, but I've never had a dog feature as prominently, I think, as Wolf does in The Lost Girls of Camp Forevermore. So how did you feel about like inhabiting a dog, really? Because you would have to write that character.
I think a lot of people write about... I think a lot of dogs in people's lives are like wonderful angels, you know, and they're like, my dog is so wonderful. My dog loves everything. My dog is so inspiring to me, you know, which is fair because a lot of dogs are like that, right? But a lot of dogs are also more complicated.
He's a complicated. And, he's a complicated dog.
They're difficult, and their love can be different, and can make them a little crazy, and can make you a little crazy because of how intensely they love. Like one thing I think about my dog is if she were a man, if I had been in that kind of, if I had been in a romantic relationship with my dog,
you would have left her.
I would have broken up with her a long time
ago.
The amount of like, you know, emotional trauma she puts me through, I would never put up with that in a romantic relationship. But it's different, and it's because she's dependent on me, and I just feel like that. I've just felt like that was really rich, especially for that character who I feel like is emotionally stunted and emotionally complex in that way. I think a dog was sort of the perfect foil for her in some ways.
She was, I remember reading it and thinking she is somewhere on the autism spectrum is what I kept thinking. High functioning Asperger's, but I mean, that's just, I used to work at social services and you know, whatever. Now my specialty is armchair diagnosis for fictional characters only fictional characters. Yeah, it's just, it's funny to me because that dog is not actually that likable either.
No.
The two of them are not particularly likable.
No.
But the two of them together.
Yes.
Are this duo.
They have a deep and obsessive relationship. Yeah. I think that's a fair reading of her. To me, it was just that she is a hyper-rational person who's not very, who doesn't have a lot of emotional intelligence or a lot of like interest in other people, really. Especially being... especially when she was young, when she was like a young girl and, you know, a young girl, like a young racialized girl, that she was so analytical and so hyper-intelligent in this way when there was so much pushback in the whole world against her and against that. And I think she grew to kind of hate people because it felt like they were slowing her down and they were holding her back and they were not appreciating her gifts such as they were. And I feel like she wants to live in this world of perfect reason, and then a dog is great because you cannot reason with them. But she also wants to be loved in this very intense way, which, you know, which only a dog could do.
Only a dog can do. Mm-hmm. Not cats. Dogs.
Yeah.
Not birds.
Dogs.
What about a lizard? Just kidding.
I have heard there was a woman who did a This American Life story about her bird that was wildly obsessed with her and hated everything else in life. Was like the kind of bird that lives to be 100.
Right. I do feel like birds have, certain types of birds do have a very intense, I mean, I don't know if it's intelligence, but they have, I don't know. They have needs.
This is a horror show to me. Like a bird stalker birds. I hate birds.
Yeah,
so that makes me want to die. But was it a budgie or like a big bird?
It was like a macaw or a parrot.
Okay, so they're not small. That's worse.
This bird like made the life of her husband and children like a living hell because the bird was bonded with this woman in the way that the bird thought the woman was its life partner. So one else is supposed to like get in between them or like, you know, touch her. And she's a husband and children who just are like, this is our lives. We're just going to put up with this.
Someone needs to write this as like a short story or even a novel.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For sure.
A horror.
Jen, this is your horror novel that you finally get to write.
I hate birds so much. Okay.
Well, I was going to say the structure of your book is extremely interesting. Mm-hmm. I really loved it. And one of the things, like we're just talking about Nita, who's one of the characters. So there are five girls that go on a camp trip. They're on a kayaking trip.
A 3-hour tour.
They go on a 3-hour tour. There are zero gingers on the trip. They're all Marianne's.
Oh, yeah. They're all Marianne's.
I mean, some are the professor. There's no Gilligan's either. No one is as useless as Gilligan in this book. Anyway.
No, there is one person who's useless, that one girl who just cries all the time.
Dina.
Yeah, Dina.
I mean, that's true of me as well.
She looks out for number one, though, in the same way. Like, she's useless, but she's not, like, useless and gregarious like Gilligan. She's useless and selfish.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's more interesting. Just kidding. Gilligan is a complex character. I would love to write more about Gilligan's Island. I'd love it.
Next book.
Oh, finally, my Gilligan's Island book. But I think it's interesting that we meet all the girls and then the book travels through time and space and gives us Nita's story first. And so we kind of are in this place narratively where we're meeting these young girls. They're like 10, 11. And then the next chapter, we're in Nita's life. And how did you decide how to structure whose story would follow as you're dipping back into the past story.
So I feel like Nina went first because the very little we see of her before that, in the sections where, in the first section where they're young girls, you kind of know enough, I think. I think a first impression of Nita tells you a lot. It's very deep and rich. Whereas like one of the other characters, Isabel, right? She's a lot quieter. She's, mm-hmm. she's harder to know. So I feel like something had to happen to, you know, which does later in the book to kind of draw out her complexities, so that you could see them in her as a little girl, right before her adult section. But I always wanted them to have these very long sections, where you spent time with each character, and then and even though it made the book very nonlinear, because we were just saying like Nita is unlikable, right? And a lot of the characters are unlikable initially, and so I needed the reader to spend a lot of time with each one because I feel like it takes that long for you to sit with them and sort of get used to their way of thinking and seeing the world.
Because as a reader, I kept wondering, now the knowing the structure, that we were going to dip back into the past and then see like a fully realized narrative of each character up to some kind of crisis point or denouement or whatever. And after reading the first part, I was like, who's going to be next? Like as both a reader and a writer, I was like trying to analyze sort of these choices. And I was totally on board with it. I loved it. And I loved that it was nonlinear. And I think when we think of things in a nonlinear fashion, it plays into how memory works and how our traumas affect us. Like, it's not like, here is traumatic moment that I will remember at other traumatic moment. It's like, oh, here is the stuff that makes us who we are.
Yeah, that was another reason why I didn't want it to be like the whole, why I didn't want it to be linear, why I didn't want like the whole campus in it to be at the very beginning and then go from there. Because then I think I would have been telling a very straightforward trauma story.
It'd be shared trauma and then boom.
Yeah, where the effects were supposed to be one-to-one and really obvious in that way. Whereas this way, it's more of like a back and forth resonance, and it's, you know, it's different in intensity for the different girls, and it appears in different ways and ways they don't even themselves would consciously recognize the connection.
Yeah. And also I think as a reader, it deepens your interest in each character and the story that is going to be, that you know, going as you move forward is going to be told about them.
There's a lot of, there's a lot of space given, not just to trauma and reactions to trauma, but a lot of space given to what I would call sort of mundane girlhood concerns. Not mundane is not a great word, but like sort of daily sort of girlhood stuff.
I have the same note.
Yeah, there we go. It's because we share a brain.
I'm glad because mine gets so tired.
Yeah, but like what I found so refreshing is how much serious literary space is given to girls at an age where they are so very often not treated with seriousness.
There's a book, The Burning Girl by Claire Massoud, that's fairly recent. And that book was interesting because it's like about a really, really aggressively ordinary girl. Like she's white and she's upper middle class and she like lives in this fictional small town in Massachusetts, and sort of nothing really bad happens to her. Like the things that happen to her are like the things that happen to everybody. And the thing, you know, and then the worst thing that happens to her best friend is like kind of a thing like that one girl at your high school, like that definitely happened to one girl in your high school, or, you know, a dozen of them. And the book reads like a horror novel, you know, it's just like such a horror show watching a totally average and privileged adolescence proceed accurately. and actually that's something that interests me right now in like from a craft perspective too, because there's a couple other books I read that I think about that, like An American Marriage by Terry Jones, That Kind of Mother by Rahman Alam. Like those are both books where, well, both of those two books, like if I describe the plot, it sounds super dramatic, right? Like An American Marriage is about a couple who, they haven't been married very long when the husband gets arrested and incarcerated for something he didn't do. And then he gets released from prison 5 years later. And then it's like, well, is their relationship going to survive? And then the other, in that Kind of Mother, it's about a woman who adopts her nanny's child after her nanny dies. And so they both like sound really dramatic, but that's like not the meat of the book. Like the meat of the book is this really like, you know, banal, domestic, everyday stuff. And that's where all the like drama and sadness comes from. It's just the like everydayness of like a romantic relationship or of like raising children, which, yeah, I think is in, is, yeah, if you just depict like real life accurately, it is very intense and, you know, emotional and rich and worthy of like that kind of literary consideration.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And yeah, I had very similar comments. And I think for me, just adding on to that was also the very, like each person has kind of, even again, if they are unlikable, if they're selfish, like they're still completely heartbreaking when we see the things that specific to them destroy them in some way. And I think so many of them coming off that, either coming from a place of girlhood, coming from a place of womanhood, coming from a place of like expectations of what women should be and should do, it's also rooted in that, like even as they age, and those heartbreaks are so specific. I mean, reading it, I was felt heartbroken many times for these characters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of them had their heartbreaking moments, yes, right? And I mean, I think the most obvious heartbreaking, well, Isabel's story, not no spoilers or anything, but I think a lot of people will find that super, super heartbreaking.
It's extreme. It's, yeah. I mean, it's just shit thing after shit thing.
Yeah, shit thing after shit thing. And then, but then Dina also, who in the novel.
You know, until now, until this moment, like looking at you, did I not realize that you had the same name as one of the characters?
I said to Jen that my name, this is the first time I've read a book with my name in it, because my name's not uncommon, but it's never in stuff. And Jen's like, I read Jen's all the time.
Jen is everywhere.
Yeah.
Like the Dina in The Lost Girls of Camp Forevermore is the one who goes and lives in that vacant house, right? In LA. Is that her?
She finds out her mom has like a weird front property.
Yeah. Yeah. I love her because she is a bitch, man. Like she's awful. Like in real life, I could never be friends with her. But then reading that story, I was like, oh, I get you now. And damn it, Kim Fu, for allowing me to see your humanity.
I also feel like the way that particular, like her particular story ended, left her in a place where with some of the other characters, we kind of saw them, I'm not going to say comeuppance, but we kind of saw them have revelations earlier and hers took way longer compared to other characters. And she's left in a place of, we know going forward that she's the thing she's going to have to reckon with are going to be just real brutal.
Her disillusionment is slow and painful, I think. And because she's very beautiful. Like she's very, you know, yes. And that is something that people tell
Wait,
her.
Wait, would you say, what was the name of that character?
Dina.
What would you say about her appearance?
Great.
Beautiful.
Dina is so beautiful.
Rosie was like, why is Dina always doing this?
But yeah, people tell her that from the time she's a young child. Like, people are really fixated on her appearance, and they're always telling her she's such a pretty girl. And I think that warps her a little bit.
Is like, that how you started with her as a character? What happens to people when they're just beautiful their entire lives? Like, what does that make them into?
Oh, you know where that character really came? The what I remember about that character is I once heard a writer talking who had written a character who was a model, and the writer said, oh, because, you know, being a model is so easy, like they're just beautiful people
how do you know that
well, I was like, that is untrue.
Like, that is a very lazy way to think about
that,
something.
Well, I mean, that also is like a person who's never watched reality television or read anything a model has ever written or said about their industry, right? It is difficult and exploitative, and, you know, people, so many people want so desperately to break into it, and it's not obvious. And
like, nothing is easy, man. Yeah. Everyone's got their own shit.
Yeah. But I mean, that was where that first started, is I wanted to write.
I love that.
About.
Yeah.
I wanted to write about that from like what I had learned from reading about modeling, especially like in particular, she's Chinese Canadian, this character, yeah, right? And so she's trying to break in as an Asian woman. And this is something I had read several times from Asian American models, is they were saying, they always tell you, like, you have to go back to Asia.
You have to go to Taiwan or Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. And then come back.
Or if you're on America's Next Top Model.
Yeah. Or you have to be
No, I mean, like, yeah, when you're on, yeah, America's Next, yeah, Top Model, they're telling you the same, yeah, thing.
Yeah, they tell you that too.
But like, you're too niche.
Oh, mm-hmm. I went to high school with someone who won Miss Chinese Vancouver. And, yeah, and then went on to try to become an actor in Hong Kong. And that was, man, that, I wouldn't have traded places with her in a million years. Mm-hmm. It was brutal.
Yeah, yeah, it is brutal, mm-hmm, right? And... But yeah, but she, yeah, but then I wanted, on top of that, she has a personality that it was very hard to dissuade her, I think, from her dreams. Like, you just couldn't break her.
Like, I think that part on one level is flawed, but also weirdly admirable. You're like, okay, well, I kind of respect your commitment to this particular type of hustle.
I think it was also the push-pull of, like, the culture she lived in. Like, I think, yeah, her mother was always trying to force realism on her that was so at odds with, like, the elementary school rhetoric, kind of, which was like, you can do anything if you work hard and put your mind to it. And then her mother was like, from a very young age, being like, you know, you have to make a living, you have to be practical. You're not that special, you know, which is the opposite of what children are told. And I think that conflict can play out in lots of ways, but for this character, it was resistance, right? Then it's like, well, they tell me I'm special at school, so obviously you're wrong about everything because you're wrong about this.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot there. I need to ask you about the names of each of these characters too. Like, where, because it's not often that I even ask anyone this question, but when I was reading the novel, the names were very distinct to me. Like, I had never mixed anyone up. Like, that never happened.
I felt the same way.
Yeah.
I was,
yeah,
always like, this is what's happening here. This is who's here. This is who's
here. But I think that's a combination of writing really well-developed characters, but also it's partly because the name is so well-matched to the character. Because the names never left my head. I always knew what their names were.
For a lot of what I do often is, I think of the year that the character was born, and then I look up the most popular names of that year.
I do that too.
Until I hit one that seems to fit. And then there's also, you know, an ethnicity match a lot of the time. Especially, and there are certain names that are more common as English names for Chinese people. Mm-hmm. Often because they transliterate easily, mm-hmm, between
nothing with a double consonant. Like, you're not going to be, yeah, naming an Asian child Reinhardt, for example.
Yeah.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
My mother would pronounce it Lai Ha.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I got it. Also, who's naming their children Reinhardt overall?
I don't know.
Like, is this a common name? Should we be looking up most popular baby names 2018 and Reinhardt's at
the top? One of my friends did name their child Andreas. And the mom of Andreas is half Chinese. And I said, is your mother going to be able to say that? She's like, oh, no. Andreas. Like, you can't eat. No way. Anyway.
It's not happening.
No.
It's fine.
But yeah, that's it. I get the names are fixed really early for me in, mm-hmm, the process. Mm-hmm. Like, and I can't think of them as having any other name.
Because they were good names and they really fit. And I was like, that's a... You know, like, because this is actually something that students ask me all the time. How do I name my characters? So there's like, I'm going to tell them to read your novel.
I also try to avoid the names of people I know. And it's so weird that I've like never made the connection between the two Dinas, but somehow I didn't.
Well, there's also a Kayla. Did, yeah, you go to school with Kayla?
No.
Okay. Kayla Saga, former guest, friend of the podcast.
There's a Kaylee. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
I accidentally named one of my characters in The End of East Jackie Chan. But it was an accident.
Oh, I forgot about that. Whatever, it happens.
It was also, the Chan, I'm sure, family.
There are lots of Jackie Chans.
She's a girl, but yeah, like in the novel, I named the family the Chan family, but I had changed their last name several times, and their first names were fixed, so I changed their last name several times, and at the end, they were just Chan family.
What was
family.
Their original last name?
I think it was Lim, maybe. But it doesn't matter. They changed a couple times.
Also, it's
fine. Why did it change?
I was looking for... So in the End of East, the family or the grandfather of the family comes to Canada at a very specific time. And at that time, from only men from a specific region of China were coming here. And also the names were commonly transliterated upon arrival in Canada a certain way. So you had to find an appropriate name for that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess whatever I had chosen the first time was not appropriate for the period and for the region.
Did you figure that out yourself in the process of writing, or did it come up in like at the end, like in copy edit or something?
No, I figured that out. I'm glad I did, because it makes me feel smart. But like I figured, but it's one of those puzzle things, like when you're writing a novel. And I will say that because you have, several different narrative threads in there, like I want to know, did you at some point just take it all apart and put it back together, like structurally?
The way I wrote it was I took a first pass at that whole overarching narrative first.
The camp one?
The camp sections, yeah. Like as though it was all one story. And then I wrote each of the adult sections kind of one at a time. And I spent a really long time with each one, kind of where I was only working on that and I was only thinking about that character and I was just sitting with her and really deep with her. And then after each one of those, I would go back and rework the camp section. And so the camp,
oh, to be more from the point of view of that particular character, or just to
just so they fit together better. And then the thing is, that happens so many times that the camp section, like my first ideas of it, are not in there at all. But that was how they worked together. Or that was my process of writing them anyway. Mm-hmm. But I always saw it with this structure. Like, I never saw it any other way, because to me it was always a story that spidered out in that particular way.
Okay, that's interesting. I have to tell you something really funny. It's not funny, but like a couple months ago, one of my good friends, Amy, who's a mom friend, her son Otis is my son's best friend, and she comes on to me one day at school pickup, and she's like, "Hey, you know a writer named Kim Fu?" And she goes, "Don't all you Chinese people know each other?" Ha ha ha. She laughs her head off. And then I'm like, "As a matter of fact, I do." And so she's like, "Oh, I read her novel for When I Was a Boy. And then I hear she's got a new one." I said, "Why, yes, I blurbed it. Would you like a copy?" So you have fans. She was like singing your praises. She's like, "My mom read for When I Was a Boy and said, I have to read it. And my sister's all read it. We passed it around." So, and now they're reading The Lost Girls.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. But I also love that you could... that, you know, you were able to throw that back. Like, I blurbed it. Not only
Are
do
you
I know her,
me?
My name is prominently on the back.
It was great. I felt so like, you know, what's the word? Like your light was shining and I got a little bit reflected. It felt so good. I was like, I do know Kim Fu.
That's why everybody feels that way about you. That's why we have the sweatshirts.
Oh, those sweatshirts. I mean, how many of those have you guys actually sold? Like one?
Oh, I have seen more than one.
We've sold
online.
a couple. What Jen said?
Yeah, what Jen said.
I think we sold a couple.
Like two, right?
I don't know. Ask Sean Cranberry downstairs at the festival.
I feel
right
like
now.
I know everybody who bought one, and I feel like it's two people.
Hey, you know what?
Sometimes I feel that way about my books. Yeah. I think I know everyone who's bought.
Oh, that's how I feel all the time too. Oh. For sure. You're just like, yeah, that person got one. Then today, someone told me they bought one, and they're like, because I'm a bad friend, and I'm like, no, you literally don't have to buy anything or do anything. Like, there's no obligation.
A bunch of my students bought your book.
I like your students.
Yeah, my students are good. And like, now you know, Amy and her mom and sisters bought your book.
Exactly. Exactly. But now, see, I do sort of know them, right? Because I know them through you. They're only one degree away.
Yeah, it's so...
But
it's
they bought
so
it independently.
Happening.
Wasn't me.
Can I tell you something I liked about your book? Your book of short stories? Because we were talking about characters being unlikable. I feel like usually when people say that, they mean... you know, the character is kind of like, well, fuck you. I don't care if you like me. But some of the characters in your book of stories, they really want to be liked.
They do want to be liked
and it doesn't
or loved.
Work,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or they like, you know, they settle for less because they so want to be liked. And that was something I related to really strongly, which I don't see a lot. Like
Or they're trying to go somewhere where they will be liked or trying to go back in time to a time when they were liked. Like it's a very, yes, desperately wanting those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everyone in this room though understands that type of character or that type of personality. Like I feel like in the conjoined, there's definitely some of that happening with several of your characters where either they're the OG type that are just like, I don't care if anyone likes me, or they're like, I only want to be liked, but in this way by a person. And I think, I don't know. I just think it's a more complex way of looking at the way we view love or relationships or desire. And it's not just this blanket sort of, yep, it's only this way or the highway.
Well, because the desire to be liked, I think, has so often...
You like when I say baby? Oh, Rosie.
Rosie just perked up. The way I call her baby sometimes.
Okay.
The way we... the desire to be liked has manifested in popular cultures, often with romantic relationships and wanting love. But the desire to be liked manifests in so many different ways in different types of relationships, right? Like, and I think that's all, I guess, all three of our books is about people and their desire to be liked in different ways, but not necessarily romantic, not necessarily.
No, I agree.
You know that one story about the woman who keeps buying gifts for her coworkers that are too much?
Yeah.
Oh, that poor woman.
I felt so strongly for that woman.
And I almost couldn't. I had to look away at some points.
And I totally related to her feeling aggravated, even though she's being ridiculous, right? Yeah. She's kind of a comic figure. I totally fell for her. It's like, why don't people appreciate this? Look how hard she's
working. And I have also, that's interesting because I've had other people react and tell me, they're like, oh my God, I worked with that person. It was extremely stressful.
Oh my goodness.
So like, the you know, who we identify with or how we view a character also, you know, all of that stuff is super personal. Like, you know, your intention can be whatever it is, but you have to let the character, like the character's got to breathe their own like fucked up truth, whatever that is.
Yeah, they have to breathe their own fucked up truth.
Yeah.
I'm most related to the character who stole cold cuts from funerals.
Great. I mean, I know you would love that. You're like, I can't wait to get all this meat home.
I'm always trying to buy people's friendship and love with food.
Yeah, for sure.
And the thing is, it worked so well when I was an undergrad because, you know,
it still works.
And everyone's hungry.
It doesn't work as well in adulthood. Like trying to get to know your neighbors, for example, if you show up with cookies or something, that does not work the way it did when I was younger, when people
are
like,
suspicious?
You can bake cookies. You know, like that's what 19-year-olds are
no,
like.
No, everyone's like, I own a KitchenAid. And you're like, damn it.
No, yeah. Okay. Now everybody can cook and people are like really picky or people are suspicious of you just showing up at their house and being like, hey, you want brownies? And they're like, no, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we'd see each other all day long. See, I feel like my dog is always barking at you.
I'm always the person that's like, I will do extra emotional labor for like affection.
Well, I think I do that also.
I know, everyone's doing it.
We all do it.
I want to ask you another question. So we did a panel today at this festival and interestingly, everyone on the panel writes multi-genre and the majority of us, our most recent books are all fiction, but everyone brought poetry today, which was super interesting and doesn't always happen. Like I think this is rare. But I think, and you said something really interesting about it, but maybe you'll repeat it. Maybe you'll say something new. But I just want to know how you kind of manage genre in your life, like different genres and how they function for you. I mean, you said something like for me, and Shalene Knight and I were talking about this a little bit on Twitter the other day, former guest, friend of the podcast, also downstairs right now.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's like, I feel a sense of completion and it's a break for me. Like poetry isn't necessarily easy, but it's a break for me to be like, okay, well, and I can work on multiple things at once, but if I'm like, this is frustrating to me, this is long prose, da 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 da, I'll be like, what if I just write a couple poems? Just to prove that I can. So I don't know, for you, what does that look like?
I have this standard answer that I always give when people ask that question, and I'm starting to rethink it back kind of because of my experience writing the poem that I read today, actually.
It's such a good poem. I loved it. It was amazing.
I was unsure of how the room was receiving it. So that's
I felt like that about what I read too. So I think it was just the room.
People loved what you read. I could hear the noises.
But it's hard to, it's so hard to tell.
They're very quiet here at UFE, actually.
It was much quieter. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah.
It's probably easier to hear the reaction noises when you're not the one reading.
I think so too.
The reaction noises for both of you were very good.
I think people were rapt. With
good,
your palm.
Good to know. Good to know. So what I usually say when people ask me that is that I find writing fiction and nonfiction really, really hard. And for me, it's a very like workmanlike process. Like I have to do tons of drafts and there's a lot of banging my head in the wall and I have to make myself do it. Like I have to be like, you know, I would rather be washing the dishes or something, but I have to be like, no, you're going to sit down, you're going to write. And then I'm really dependent on other people too. Like I need to send it to people and have them read it and validate it or tell me to throw it away or whatever. Right. Whereas with poetry, it's much more like I do it for myself. And I trust in my own judgment a lot more. Like if everybody told me that a poem was garbage and I would really believe in it, I'd be like, well, you're just all wrong. Which is not how I feel about, about prose. But like I've been focusing really hard on fiction lately. Like this past year or maybe a little more, like a year and a half, I've been really focused on fiction to the exclusion of everything else. Like I haven't been writing nonfiction. I haven't been writing poetry. And then And so this is how I've always thought about poetry. But then, like, lately, I felt, like, too emotionally upset, kind of, to write prose. And I realized, like poetry was the only thing I could reach for. It was, like, the only thing that would do. And today at the panel, I quoted Keith Millard, who I always want to say Maillard, even though he's told me, like, 100 times it's not how you say it.
I've mispronounced his name early on many times.
Friend of the podcast, Keith Millard.
Upcoming guest.
Yes. Yeah, he has a book out right now.
We're going to have him on the podcast.
Twin Studies. Also, my blurb is on that one, too.
Yes. It was, that is I love that book.
I'm really excited to read it.
Yeah, I quoted him because something he said to us is, we turn to poetry when nothing else will do.
I think, you know, emotionally for me, yet poetry is so, like, when my marriage was dying and then, like, the years after my separation, all I did was write poetry because I couldn't sit down and think about writing a novel. I couldn't sit down and think about fiction's really difficult for me. Like, fiction has never been the easiest. I mean, it's always ironic. Like, anyone who's known me since I was a student was surprised that I came to novels, because it was never anything that I wrote as a student at all. And they're the hardest things. Like, novels suck up your life. They suck up everything. The poetry feels like much more of a natural emotional fit. Nonfiction is very hard. I agree. But it depends. I mean, when I wrote Gentlemen of the Shade, it was like picking my brains out through my nose with a fork every single day when I was sitting, because you have to prove what you're saying is true. And I'm like, no, but I write novels. If I say it's true, it's true.
Right? Yeah.
You know, and that was the hardest part for me, being able to back it up and not just make blanket statements about shit, which is, you know, when I first started, on the Twitter, what was so great was I could just say anything and people would believe me. It felt like I could just say you know, whatever. And then when I had to, like, expand that into a book, I was like, okay, now I have to back that shit up. What's wrong, everybody?
Yeah. I mean, this is also why I turn to humor. Like, I feel like I can be truthful, but I also have this buffer between me and someone, I don't know, coming for me.
Oh, they're always going to come for you.
They are, but it's in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Jen, are you feeling emotional?
I'm always emotional.
Okay, great. Let's get to this emotion corner.
Let me get this.
Let me get a timer.
Let me get my notes out.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Here we go.
Okay, so I recently did an event for the Vancouver Writers Fest with Miriam Taves, and it was a really, really wonderful event. But one of the questions that I asked Miriam, which came from Hannah McGregor, former guest friend of the podcast, was about whether, as women, if you're a female writer, whether you feel the need to also be an activist and to also constantly rep for your politics, whether we're always doing that kind of work. And it was a really interesting question. And then I started thinking about, where does that line fall for me? How much of an activist do I have to be, and how much of an artist am I? And can I just stop being an activist and point people to my art? And then I'm like, but then people will have to read, like, poetry and novels, and maybe people don't want to do that when it's much easier just to read my Twitter feed. But it all comes down to the fact that I am really tired. Like, it's been how many years that we've been going hard on the politics? 3, almost 4. And I think I want to be done, which is, don't hold me to it, that, like, I can change my mind any second now, but I might change it. All I'm saying is, if my Twitter feed goes dark, don't be alarmed. Or if the only thing I'm tweeting is about my dog. Yeah. I know, but, like, it's exhausting.
No,
and I do feel.
Yeah. And you should save that for your art.
I should. Well, I mean, not that I should or shouldn't. I mean, it depends how you want to, you know, manage your art.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It's about, like, how you want to spend your time.
It's how you want
and
to do
also,
it.
And also, sometimes you'll have energy for some things and not other things. Like, it's not some.
Yeah. And if.
Well,
you,
of.
Yeah. You if know. It was a phase, if it was a phase of your yeah. life and your art and your career, it was a wonderful one that was, like, really helpful and edifying to a lot of people. And
I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes that, like, when you're a woman, and particularly if you're, like, a woman of color, and you've got any kind of, like, public platform, so much of that labor falls on you. Yeah. And I feel that people ask me these really laborious questions constantly, or want, you know, really well thought out opinions about stuff. And, like, half the time I'm like, I don't know. I just really like hickory sticks, and I just want to roll up in a duvet with my dog and not think about it, you know? But then I also feel like that sort of ignoring the politics is something that people with privilege do, and I should be better than that. But then I don't know if I should be or shouldn't be or what. Like, there's so many shoulds that shouldn't exist, if that makes sense.
I think I'm with what Dina said, like that you can move physically too, right? Like yeah. It can be like, you know, you did great work and I hope you feel that way. But then if like this is a phase where you need to pour your energies into something else, that's fine. And it doesn't mean you'll never come back to it again, right? Or that you're not being political in other ways, perhaps ways that are not so like public or like demanded of you performatively, right?
Yeah.
And you can do different things at different phases of your art and again, your career.
That you, I mean,
that's freeing actually.
It's also this like to everyone is also doing things in their personal life that are exactly like what you said, not public. Like we just talked about, you know, the concept of acknowledgments, of acknowledging people in our lives. But like some of that work is extremely valuable, but not everything can be public. Like some of that stuff needs to be private to protect people, to keep them safe. And so there are all sorts of things that are happening that are still extremely political, but that they can't take place in the realm of the public. And again, I believe that there will always be people picking up the mantle. And I think it's cyclical, like art creation. Like you're not constantly writing all the time. Everyone has fallow times or times where you just can't. Like,
oh, so many times.
What if you have to work 60 hours a week and you're just like, you're trapped in whatever.
Mm-hmm. What if you're dealing with your child's panic attacks? Like I was not that long ago.
Someone in your life is chronically ill or has whatever it is. Family doesn't matter. Like there's also, it could just be your own reason. You're just like, guess what? I want to be fucking lazy now and I'm allowed.
You know, I think maybe part, and then I'll stop talking about my emotions, but I think part of it though too is that like, cause I'm writing that nonfiction / memoir / cultural criticism book now. And so much of that is deeply political. And I think all of my energy has gone there and I'm not interested in doing that online at the moment. Cause I'm writing this book that it really 100% addresses all of those things.
I mean, I also just want to say you still do that because you can't help yourself. Too.
No, I know. But like, I'm limiting it to subtweets now.
But you're just like, you're popping in when you feel like it.
Hey listeners, it's Dina. I just need to let you know that there was a complete, for the second time during the recording of Can't Lit, freak glitch in the recording. So you got most of it. What you ended up missing was the rage minute and all that boring stuff that everyone hates where we tell you to follow us on the internet. So you can follow us on Can't Lit. You can go to cantlit.ca. Please give us those 5 stars that we beg for every episode. Tell your friends. Subscribe. All of that business. You should definitely check out Kim's book. You can follow her, as previously mentioned, at Skim Foo. Oh, I think on Twitter she has a different name. No, also Skim Foo. Great name. Great name. And her website is kim-foo.com. And I'm going to give you this rage minute, but it's not going to have the passion behind it because all my passion is going into hating how bad I am at editing the podcast. So I sincerely apologize to everyone for the lost 5 minutes of the podcast. But there'll be a little something at the end, but it's not that exciting. Well, it is. What Kim says is great. So here's my rage minute. Lice. Holy shit. They are monstrous little shits. Did you know that female lice are cum hoarding queens who store jizz so they can lay like a gazillion eggs in your hair? I mean, they're wily because they don't need to rely on gross male lice to propagate, which I respect, but also I hate them and they're vile. And apparently my clean, undyed hair that I don't put products in was a perfect nesting ground. So lucky me. So my head is now a crusty and it's snowy with dandruff, but I guess, knock on wood, that's better than lice. But everything sucking the blood from your body is not cool, in my opinion, you little fuckers. I would have given a kidney for some DDT, well, now, like, over a month ago. So thank you for listening to my Rage Minute, and thanks for tuning in overall. Really sorry. If anyone wants to volunteer to help me with the podcast, you know where to find me, the internet. Okay, thanks. Bye. Oh, and one more thing. We're going to start up with where we ask Kim what she can't with.
crusty TV.
Kim, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
That's it.
Bye.